everybody. Welcome to our conversation to the Apologetics Canada podcast. Before we get started, just a disclaimer here. My wife is very, very pregnant. So if you hear if you hear some rustling and you don't hear Steve anymore, you know that's where I am at. So she's full term, 38 weeks, past 38 weeks. And
is she past her due date?
Not past her due date, past 38 weeks. So it could come anytime. It's her second one too, so it might be a little early. Who knows?
How could you be full term and not pass your due date?
They consider 37 week full term. So,
but doesn't full imply due?
No.
Flesh that out for me, because I
apparently not not with respect to pregnancies. They consider 37.
So by full, I think they mean fully developed. Ready
to
come. Be received into the world.
So if she were to be born now, like you could have a home birth and that sort of a thing, but if it's before 37 weeks, they find it a little bit too risky to do something like that. So we would have to go to a hospital, that sort of a thing. 40 weeks is like due, and then but even then, that's a fuzzy line there.
Do you know? I have two kids, and the whole birth thing to me is just weird. Like, I guess for some people, it's a magical, wonderful experience. But for me, I would have rather have just sat outside the hospital door, you know, like the old school. You sat on the bench and you just patiently waited.
Pace into the rug, like,
walk back and forth, you know, as you hear screaming in the background.
Box of cigars at the ready.
Yeah, to which you hear, you know, the doctor call out from behind the door, you know, it's a boy. I would have preferred
clear.
That. Steve, how do you fare with the whole birth thing? Are you ready? Are you like in there with a catcher's glove? Like,
yeah.
Like, honestly, one of the doctors seriously said, you know, she wanted me to catch the baby, mm-hmm. like participate in the birth process. And I'm like, yeah. I'm good. I just get to be up here, you know, supporting my wife, holding her hand.
Yeah,
I've seen enough.
I'm actually looking forward to the baby. Can't wait to meet the little one. We're going to have a son. And this is our, on my wife's side, this is the first son that they have. She has two nieces. So looking forward to it. I am going to catch the baby and cut the cord and the whole nine yards. And
you're in there like a dirty shirt.
Yeah.
That doesn't bother you.
Yeah. It's, I'm okay with that.
So, Dr. Steve.
Maybe that's what I missed my calling in life. I should have gone into medical something or other. But
there you go.
I love what I do here.
It's,
so
it's never too late.
You can mix apologetics and birthing.
Hey, there are some great
delivering.
yeah, there's John Patrick is maybe someone to look up to. I don't know. Anyway, moving into our topic of the day, we were going through the news lately, and this has been out for a little while now, but China has repealed their one-child policy, and now they have two-child policy. So they still have a cap. If you have more than two children, then you still go through the same penalties and things like that, but at least you can have more than one child. So I just want to hear your take on that.
Those people who accidentally or purposely had two kids, they're still fined and still under, you know, the same kind of regulations. Like it wasn't annulled. It's kind of, well, it's, you know, I was reading this. It was interesting. It's been in the news. It's been in different magazines and whatnot. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that's kind of interesting about it is, one, it's a demonstration that population sizes are on the decline, particularly mm-hmm. in China. Clearly it's on the decline if they're going to allow for a two-child policy. As well, there's also a number of just practical implications to having a one-child policy with two parents, mm-hmm. such as who's gonna take care of your parents, right?
Right, when mm-hmm. they get old, yeah.
I mean, like, and how does that work economically? Like, mm-hmm. What's the social security policy, mm-hmm. like, with regards to who's gonna be providing for that generation that's in need?
Yeah, mm-hmm. it's crazy. I think it's important to note that there was four, I believe it was four provinces, at least that's what I've read, in China that were actually able to have two children since 1979, the inception. That was the year the one-child policy came into inception, mm-hmm. or began. Wow, my English ain't so good this morning.
You know, I have those mornings.
Yeah.
It's pretty much every morning.
These are the mornings when I feel really good about myself.
Yeah, here, I'm just I must decrease, so Steve may increase. But at any rate, so there was four provinces. So now that they will just maintain, but reading testimonies from some of the people that came from those provinces, particularly there was a fruit seller I was reading about this morning, and he was saying pretty much for the same reason that you just said, two children are indeed better than one. And for those of you who study demographics, you know that in order for a population just to even maintain itself, you need 2.1 children per childbearing family.
Because of the mortality rate.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Okay. And then if you want to increase, you have to go upwards of three. But they've been hovering at about 1.5 or what have you for the longest time. So that's obviously why their population has been decreasing. So it's interesting that even with a two-child policy, their population isn't going to stabilize. So a lot of the reports I've been reading have said, well, this isn't enough. Like, what's your guys' goal? So I've heard of places calling for them to start adopting immigration policies, stronger ones, bringing in people. And, you know, people are crying, well, that's crazy. Why would you do that if you're trying to decrease the population? But for precisely economic reasons that you alluded to, Stagger.
And they shouldn't have any issues with increasing the population if they wanted to do that.
Exactly.
Right? Well, but that's the curious part of the whole thing. Is a lot of what I've read on it says, listen, even if they just open it up whole hog and just said, go wild, have as many kids as you want, people don't even seem interested in having two kids, let alone the one.
This is the interesting part. And Andy's been known to... did you coin the term affluenza?
No, I wish I did.
It's really good. For those of you who don't know, there's a term called affluenza, and it sort of, I guess, plays off influenza.
Yeah.
But it has to do with affluence. And us in the West, we're pretty much the carriers of this disease, right? And we've been, you know, spreading it. This is
our consumerism.
Yeah. Well, I mean, this is ISIS's big thing against us, right? Or many people in that end of the world is like, they don't want us spreading our Western values throughout. And in this case, it's kind of true in that many people in China, even the ones that have been allowed to since 2013, they instituted policy. If you were a one child family, you could have two children. So there was something like 11 million of these couples that were able to sign up to have two children if they wanted, but about 12% did. It was something like 1.45 million. And so that's speaking to the fact that people are like, you know what, we're happy with just having one kid or no kids because we just, you know, we want to have our fun or we think it's too expensive to have a child. And this is interesting because this is what everybody in the West is saying. Not everybody, I should say, speaking to two guys with two kids in front of me, but do you know what I'm saying? A lot of people are saying, well, we don't want to have no kids or one kid in order
being
to
be embraced by a lot of people.
Well, yeah. And it's hedonism, right? In a sense.
In a sense. I see that even, I saw that growing up in Korea too, like my grandparents' generation was all about having lots of children. And you had stories of parents going the distance, like working like 12-hour days to provide for their like four or five children. Very common. But even with my parents' generation, the baby boomers' generation, that started like really petering out. But even then it was okay. It's coming down to my generation now where it's so westernized, right? So it's a typical, you know, we're going to have just one child or maybe two children, not going to have any more than that, and get married later because, you know, career is the foremost thing. And more and more it's becoming like the West in that regard. So it's really interesting watching it from this end of the...
Have you noticed any impacts on society so far from that?
Yeah, there's a huge concern economically, actually, because now we have... It's an upside down pyramid now, right? So there we have more seniors, more and more we have the proportion of the seniors is growing compared to the next generation. So the next generation can't take care of the older generation, and market wise, now we have a smaller client base, right? So all of the companies that kind of exploded with, you know, the baby boomers generation as their client base, now they have to downsize everything. So the economy is now suffering. So that's just a couple of manifestations.
And those are the challenges, you know, particularly the idea was in the past, you know, you had lots of kids because they were your retirement, Paul. You know, that was your retirement.
Yeah.
Was your kids. And that's, by the way, that's why in a lot of these countries, people want boys. And it's because that's their mantle that they continue on. They take care of the parents.
Yep.
So really, I think a lot of people confuse why in these other countries, the developing nations, why they want boys so bad. Mm-hmm. You know, it's they want a retirement policy really bad.
Exactly.
Yeah. And so what you have now is, you know, with people having less kids, it's more on the government than to provide for this aging population. But the problem is, you know, if you're going to do that, you have to have enough people in the workforce to carry that burden. And and so China's in a unique place, as a lot of nations are right now. Who's going to carry that burden? Now, interestingly enough, with China, a lot of what I've been reading as well is just they're in this phase of trying to save face in the midst of it all and not admit that they were actually wrong in the policies that they implemented.
Yeah. By the way, before we move on, there has been a text message from Nancy. She's going to make a Timmy's run before she gets here, and she's asking if we want anything. So you might want to reply to that if you want something.
I already did.
You already did? Yeah. Oh, dang, yo. Okay.
I'm way ahead of you.
Yeah, okay. You're way ahead of me. Okay.
I just wanted to, in speaking to that, I've been thinking a lot about this and just seeing, and this is going to be
a lot about what?
Sorry, the problem that China is seeing themselves in right now, and it's going to just be escalating because right now it's something like 30% of their population is 50 or above, and that's going to keep going because in a lot of ways they still have a decent quality of living. However, they don't have the same view on human rights, I think, that we do in the West that's able to sustain a population that old. And so I think it's not outside the realm of possibility that there could be some sort of weird euthanasia or something like that happens later on in life, like an age limit policy. Right. That goes in.
That's an age limit policy.
What's to stop that, right? Because there's been coerced.
You've lived long enough, my brother.
Exactly. Yeah. And, you know, we're going to cap it at 70, and then that's it, right? Because, I mean, they've done coerced abortion for as a penalty, right? Sometimes they levy fines. Sometimes they force abortions upon women who have gone over the child policy. Mm-hmm. So I don't really see anything in their worldview, right? Their political or societal worldview that would stop them from doing that.
There's only one thing that's seeming to creep into China that is an influence, a positive influence, and that's Christianity.
Exactly.
Christianity is growing rapidly throughout China. And fast, in fact, Christianity is currently growing faster in China than it did in the inception of the church in the first century.
Really?
Yeah. That's fascinating.
I knew it was going fast, but I didn't realize it was
a whole number of articles came out. I don't know, what was it, Steve, last year or the year before on this?
I think it was last year, yeah. I think I know which one you're talking about.
We haven't seen the church grow this fast since it first began.
That's amazing. Right. And it just goes to show the darkness that people are fleeing from, in a sense, right? Because the gospel is so appealing, and it seems to grow fastest. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It seems to grow fastest when there's that real need for hope.
Yeah, in studying Western thought, that the point keeps coming up that one thing that really kind of sets the Western kind of thinking apart is that sanctity of life.
Well, it's interesting. I was reading about this. In fact, we'll post this on our website, the quote. But there's a scientist from China that was talking about how when China was developing, that they were looking at other nations like the United States and elsewhere and saying, okay, what is it that has made them so successful? And they ultimately concluded that it was Christianity. And so this has really been a challenge to them, particularly as a communist nation. You know, how do they make sense of the fact that it's the worldview that they are operating from that has led to their success as a nation? We'll post the quote Chinese scholars.
Yeah, that I find it really interesting. It seems to me that China often does something to deal with one problem, but whatever they do ends up creating several more. I remember back during the, I heard the story of their cultural revolution, and they wanted to kill all the sparrows because these birds were coming and eating the crops. So people would get paid. If they caught sparrows and brought them into the authorities, they would get paid. But of course, as they started doing that, what they didn't realize was now there were no predators left to eat the little bugs, right? Now they had insect epidemic. So I see something similar in the one child policy. You know, they curbed one problem, like population control, right? But then there are a whole bunch of others.
It's amazing how evil acts, like people end up reaping what they sow, in a sense, right? Like things always seem to come back to haunt them.
Yeah.
You know what? I don't like sparrows, so I'm kind of glad they killed them all.
I'm not.
I'm just kidding.
And he's like, and squirrels too.
Yeah, and squirrels too. No, squirrels is legit. I have a real issue with squirrels.
Yeah.
But this actually, this topic leads into what we've been going into with regards to evil and this idea of how should the world be and how shouldn't the world be.
Exactly. Because when we make these claims, or we make these observations, I should say, it seems to me that we have an inherent idea about the way the world should be, not just how it could be or anything like that. There's no speculation. We have an ingrained understanding, right?
Yeah, it's a presupposition that we start with. And I think if you start dig deep enough, that a lot of what we kind of just assume just doesn't work. Like, for example, I would say that a lot of atheists and agnostics and other skeptics would place survival at the top of the value chain, right? That's the most important thing. But then my question is, why survival, right? It's just, if that atheistic physicalist world is really what we have here, then it's just different configurations of particles and energy. That's all it is. So I don't know what kind of value there would be to survival other than what we just give to it subjectively.
Well, and I've been thinking a lot about this lately. There's another aspect to this conversation where you could say, okay, let's just flip that now on its head, the whole survival thing. Because one of the things I've been thinking a lot about it with regards to our culture and a lot of the values that we have as a culture is, I think, has been influenced by some degree by Maslow's hierarchy of needs. This idea that, you know, it's a pyramid again, but the pyramid starts with your basic fundamental needs that we...
Like physical needs.
Yeah, our physical needs, our need for food, our need for shelter. And then these needs that come up from there, such as our need for safety, and then our need for love and acceptance. And
where would Applebarn be on that?
You know, Applebarn's actually at the very top.
That's right.
Self-actualization is the pinnacle, and that's what happens when you go to the Applebarn, particularly when you eat Johnny Gold apples, which I'm mourning the loss of right now at this point in the season. But you know, I think this is quite interesting, though. That our culture operates from this idea that if you fulfill these needs, you'll work your way up this pyramid till you get to this place of self-actualization and fulfillment, ultimately. But this is the real challenge I see in our culture, particularly our broken, messed up culture. You know, is why bother heading up the pyramid?
Well, because that's the question that comes to my mind: is like, who cares, or what's the point?
Quite honestly. And when we live in such a physicalist worldview, I mean, notice many of those things, once you get beyond the very first level of the pyramid, you know, it's questioned whether or not those things even exist. So again, you know, why do you work your way up this pyramid? And this runs into the whole evil problem. Well, why not just stay at that fundamental level of, you know, food, shelter, you know, your physical needs, and then you just do whatever you need to do to fulfill those needs. Now, what I think is interesting about Christianity is that Christianity flips that pyramid on its head. and says, no, it doesn't start with your whole physical needs and everything. It actually starts with your spiritual needs, that those are actually more fundamental to who you are and much more necessary. That you start with fulfillment that is found in Christ, and it's from there that you proceed everywhere else. It's from that point that you begin to proceed to love, security, blah, 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 physical needs. And this begins to change the way you see and operate in the world, particularly in a world as broken and as messed up as ours. Like just recently in the news, there was a home invasion that happened in Indianapolis, I believe.
Yes, somewhere down in around there.
Yeah, and here was a couple like yourself, Steve. I mean, they had had one child, from what I understand. This guy is a pastor at a local church there.
And she was pregnant.
Yeah, and his wife was pregnant, and she was shot during this home invasion, right?
And he had to come home and find it.
Yeah, and he comes home after the gym.
Yeah,
finds his wife, you know, dead at their house, and now he's got to wrestle through the evil of this world, right? I mean, that's the problem with evil, right? Is evil's not just something that we know about, you know, factually. You know, evil is something that we experience personally, and challenges everything in our worldview about where do we go from here. And I think it's interesting what he posted online, as he posted online that he says something to the effect of, "Hey, I still think that God is good, you know, and he's in control." I've heard other people, you know, that have gone through a horrific experience or have seen something horrific on the news, and, you know, just says, "God forgive them," right? They know not what they do, right? They're quoting Jesus at that point. And what's taking place, I think, is something that's interesting and unique to Christianity. And that is the ability to still operate in a broken and messed up world, even though your self-actualization, if you will, is being hampered. Because, you know, you're looking for those physical needs, you're looking for that safety net, you know, that helps you to proceed. And the problem is we live in a broken, evil, messed up world. Everybody's going to experience evil, and you're never going to be able to move up that hierarchy of needs. The reason I bring this up is I think there's so many people in our culture that live unfulfilled lives, that are harboring so much bitterness and hatred and anger, that have no idea how to operate in such an evil and broken world. And I really think it has a lot to do with the fact that they've got the whole structure backwards.
Yeah, I think it's when people encounter these events, the automatic question is why. Why is this happening? And fundamentally, what's going to happen, or they're going to rest their experience on however they view the world, right? So if they view the world from a completely naturalist point of view, there's no rhyme or reason. And if you're able to actually just stay there, I mean, in some sense, that can give kind of solace, right? But at the same time, it gives no answer and gives no reason to want to move forward.
Well, and that's the thing too, because nobody's looking at that indifferently.
No.
Right? Everyone's looking at that going, no, this is wrong, this is evil, and it's making me not feel good inside.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And that goes back to what Steve was saying earlier about the presuppositions. We all live as if that is unjust, right? Like there's something happened that's wrong. Mm-hmm. So if it's actually wrong, how can I get justice, or how can I get from that something that my worldview is incapable of producing? And it's not just naturalism that's incapable of producing that. There's numerous worldviews where you don't see that at the end of the day coming to a point of being able to forgive those that harm us. In fact, that I know of, that the only one that has it built in, right, is Christianity.
Yeah. And I think in other religions where they have that concept, often it seems to me like they've borrowed it from Christianity, that idea of, or at least the forgiveness is very kind of, how do I put this? It's like you have to kind of earn it in a sense. Like this is a little bit different, but in Islam, the concept of being forgiven by God, you basically have to earn your way to it. And so then I have to wonder, well, is that even forgiveness, really? Because you've earned it, right? Now God owes you. If you've done all these good things and God is supposed to forgive you, then that's what God owes you. But so anyway,
this is why I think the Sermon on the Mount is so interesting. Here Jesus comes on the scene, right? And the sermon that he gives is often referred to as the upside-down kingdom. Is Jesus is flipping everything on its head. Everything that you assumed was the way that things should be is, in fact, the complete opposite of the way that they are. Mm-hmm. And I guess that's the point that I'm trying to make, is that we still keep wanting to fall into that same rut. Right. And it will leave you longing. It will leave you in a state of brokenness in this brokenness. Mm-hmm. It's not until you flip these things upside down and you see the world, getting back to this idea of worldview, see the world through God's eyes, that I think that we can begin to even operate in a world that's so broken.
Yeah, I know for myself, even then, like forgiving people with a self-serving idea towards it, right? Like I've experienced that myself, where I'm like, okay, well, I want to feel better about myself, and I understand that forgiveness can help me, so I'll look at it from that point of view, right? It'll help me be better. And that, in a sense, is just as flawed, right? Even offering forgiveness, it's the heart of the matter that becomes a part of it. And that, I think, speaks to the flipping it, right? Because it's not about me, it's about God and setting the world to rights, right? It's about justice. It's not about me feeling better.
I think at the end of the day, I think when people realize that this is a God issue, you know, that we have our own, you know, different struggles that we have with it, no doubt. But this, at the end of the day, it seems to me that we ultimately hold God accountable for the evil of this world and the injustices. And at the end of the day, it comes back to our relationship with God. Which raises the question, because notice people, when they suffer, when they have the challenge of, or the problem of evil, isn't the problem of your evil or my evil or his evil. Mm-hmm. It's the problem of evil in face of God. That seems to be the dilemma.
Yeah, why would God let this happen, or why didn't God stop it? Or people put it differently, but or in Korea, we always refer to the heavens. Why would the heavens do this or whatever? Or, oh, the heavens just don't care. You know, that's how we put it. The heavens just don't care.
Let me throw one out there to you and see how do you feel about this one? This is a common idea, is that God has allowed this evil, broken, messed up world as a history lesson.
As a history lesson. Yeah. I don't think I've really heard that before.
Is that tied into sort of like the school for souls? Like it's meant to teach us how to... Okay.
Yes.
To... In some sense,
particularly for this idea that when this is all over and we're in heaven, that people would argue then that there won't be a fall again because we have this history lesson
right,
to look back upon.
Right. So when we go to heaven, the argument, as I understand it, then is like, for example, you wouldn't give the illustration that Clay Jones used was you wouldn't give a pen to a 1-year-old, right? Because she might just
or give a knife to a 1-year-old.
Yeah, she might just kind of stick it into herself. But you give me a knife, I'll never stick it into myself because I'm way too smart for that, right? I know.
We hope.
Yeah, we're hoping. Crossing the fingers, you know. So I think that would kind of go along with what you're saying. Evil and suffering as a history lesson, I think it could be an aspect of it. I don't know if that's the ultimate purpose that God set out in allowing evil and suffering.
Yeah, I'm with you on that.
Yeah,
I'm
but I think that. It's an aspect, certainly after the fact that it's happened, now this is how it can be used.
Yeah.
But I'm not sure that as far as I'm concerned, I think it would impugn God's character if I were to hear that, you know, if it's true that God specifically let this happen for the ultimate purpose of teaching us lessons, then I would kind of have to wonder, well, what about the people that suffered, that they were just kind of used as, you know,
object lessons? Yeah.
Right.
Well, because I mean, ultimately it would seem that he's not allowing it to happen. He's in a sense causing it to happen, if that's the purpose, right? Because if his purpose is to teach, then you'd think he would be having to make up a lesson plan. Right,
so to speak, yeah.
So to speak. So it would sort of, in a roundabout way, make him the author of evil.
This, by the way, is an important aspect of this question of why does God allow evil that I think a lot of Christians miss. Mm. And the answer to the question is quite simply, we don't know.
Mm-hmm.
God hasn't specifically told us why he mm-hmm. has allowed evil. We have we have good reasons to think that that we might know such as the free will defense,
mm-hmm.
and that is, you know, maybe this is the only possible world that God could have created, particularly if his end purpose was relationship with people.
Mm-hmm. And his people to have free choice.
Right. And God can't guarantee that they won't, you know, choose not to, you know, that they won't choose evil, you know, that it's an inherent risk in creating, you know, people for relationship. And so this mm-hmm. is a risk that God was willing to take. He did take, and here we are in a broken, messed up world. But a lot of people miss this idea of defense. It's a free will. It's not a free will answer.
Yeah.
It's a free will defense.
It's a, it's a plausible explanation.
That's right. And that's all that it's meant to be. Mm-hmm. I bring this up just cause I've met so many people that get confused on this cause they'll hear, you know, Plantinga give this argument, although he doesn't even hold to the argument.
He's a Presbyterian.
Yeah.
Isn't he?
Reformed. He's a reformed. Yeah. Philosopher.
Mm-hmm.
And he uses this, though, he uses this mm-hmm. line of thinking just to demonstrate a possible answer, which demonstrates that we don't have a logical contradiction between an all-powerful, all-good God that would allow evil. And what we're saying is, well, it's possible that God has a good reason mm-hmm. for allowing the evil that we experience, and it's for a better purpose.
Yeah, I think... it's really important, I think, to understand the nature of the accusation or the charge
mm-hmm.
brought on by whoever is questioning, you know, God's character and things like that, you know, the problem with evil and suffering, because the charge is one of inconsistency, right? God's character in the face of evil and suffering, it's mutually exclusive. You can't have both. If you have one, you can't have the other. But when the charge is one of inconsistency, you don't have to show the answer. All you have to do is show a possible answer.
Exactly.
If there is even a possible answer, it shows that it's not mutually exclusive.
Mm-hmm. And the encouraging thing for me is at the end of the day, what God does show us is that he's willing to walk through it with us and that he can make good come out of it. Mm-hmm. Right, like I know in my
life. He's not some sort of deistic God that just leaves us in the mud mm-hmm. and just says,
good luck.
Yeah,
just hope it works out.
He mm-hmm. was willing to enter into our brokenness.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. And not only in the person of Jesus Christ, but now continually in through his indwelling of us.
Yeah, mm-hmm. For those of you, if you've read Andy's book, Thinking, Answering Life's Five Biggest Questions, at the end of it, in chapter 6, we end up talking about my story, and then mm-hmm. I had an experience of God in a hotel room going through a very, very dark time where God was there with me. And mm-hmm. I remember being, in a sense, shocked mm-hmm. that he was there and willing to walk through it with me. And he actually took this terrible episode in my life and used it to catapult me spiritually, relationally, mm-hmm. and all of these things and completely changed my life through these terrible acts. So it's to me, I have firsthand experience, and I think we all do when we turn back to God, right? Because it's about mm-hmm. repentance and looking to him and seeing how, and then just essentially waiting to see what he's going to do with it. Right.
Mm-hmm.
And what happens in a relationship with God then is it infuses all of life with meaning, both the good and the bad, particularly when we see this evil world in light of the much bigger picture of eternity. Mm-hmm. And I think that this is what Paul continually talks about as he says that he focuses his attention on his hope, which is the life to come, not the life mm-hmm. that we're living.
Okay, well, that's a very good note to end on. We'll come back. I think you guys are... we're not coming back next week, are we?
Chris and I will be. We're heading off to Atlanta to the mm-hmm. Evangelical Philosophical Society.
Woo-hoo.
In fact, I'm going to be speaking out there at the conference, mm-hmm. the Apologetics Conference that takes place with that.
And I'll be his groupie.
Yeah.
Yeah, unfortunately, I can't be there with you guys because, well, baby, I have a baby coming.
Baby time.
So
we'll do some podcasting from out there. It'll be good stuff.
Yeah, good stuff. Looking forward to it. Yeah, looking forward to it. Well, thanks for joining us, everybody. This Apologetics Canada podcast has been a minister of Apologetics Canada. We'll see you next week, minus Steve, and I'll come back in a couple weeks, but you'll hear more from Andy and Chris next week. So ciao for now.